Hey there, welcome to the Creative Classroom Podcast. I'm your host, John Spencer. I'm a former middle school teacher, current college professor, and I am passionate about seeing teachers transform their classrooms into bastions of creativity and wonder. So on this podcast, I share strategies and ideas, I tell stories, I share my big epic fails that I've made along the way, and trust me, I am still learning and on this journey. And I also interview experts who are doing amazing work, whether that is someone who's in the classroom right now, or if it's a professor, a researcher, someone in the creative arts and industry. I love talking to people who can share strategies and ideas about what it means to help students reach their creative potential. And so that's what I did today. I interviewed someone named Scott Witthoft, and he has some bold ideas on rethinking the notion of a prototype. And if you listen to this podcast for a while, you know I am passionate about design thinking. I co-wrote the book Launch, which was all about how to make design thinking work at the K-12 level. And so when I had the chance to interview Scott, I was super excited about this opportunity. And I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. A little bit about Scott. He is an educator, designer, and author. Drawing from his past life in the practice of forensic structural engineering, he incorporates that expertise with current pursuits in space, furniture, and product design. And along the way, he's frequently teaching and speaking widely. He is the co-author of the book Make Space, and also this new book about the whole concept of what it means to prototype. And the title of this book is This is a Prototype. And I love it. It ends with a question. It was a great book. It's highly visual. It's part of that D-School series that I have really enjoyed. And he has also authored articles for the Conference Board and for Harvard Business Review. His work's been featured in the Design Museum and publications such as Fast Company, Architecture and Urbanism, and Metropolis. So without further ado, here is this interview with Scott. All right, I have with me Scott Witthoft. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much. It's cool to be here.
I'm glad to have you here. You're going to be talking about this idea of prototyping, what it means, what it looks like, this broader definition of it. I loved that. I got a chance to look at your book a little bit and think through this idea of prototyping. And it was this combination of shaking my head going, yes, yes, this is it. But also at other times thinking, wow, I never considered that before. So it was this great combination. And I'm super excited to have you here. Before we get started with that, I would love to hear a little bit about your background story. So I'd love to just have you share a little bit about yourself.
Sure. Thanks very much. Well, in my head, it's linear. So apologies to anybody, you know, for whom this seems nonlinear. Professionally, I started out practicing in engineering, civil engineering and structural engineering. So, you know, when I was going to school, going to college, all that, it was, I was following a path of civil and structural engineering, which was interesting to me. But I also had a lot of other interests. Probably every other interest might be more accurate. So there was always a matter of like, oh, I'm really interested in design and art and education and sciences, all that. So at one point, sort of professionally, I shifted from, you know, the practice of engineering, into design. And that has led me to applying design in contexts of education. I also do a lot of work related to designing collaborative spaces, so space and furniture design and physical product design, and how it impacts people. I also do quite a bit of design strategy work, kind of on those topics as well. So practice-wise, it's always felt kind of all part of the same sort of curiosity-driven exploration, almost regardless of the, the name of the field, say. So I always always feel like I'm finding myself noticing something and following up on that, which has been a really cool opportunity so far.
So when you think about this background, one of the things I'm struck by is how connected and integrated all of those pieces are, and that we tend to kind of think of each of those as being in different silos, different practices, different disciplines. When you were pursuing all of these different interests, did it feel to you like it was interconnected, or did you ever feel like I might be wasting my time on this piece, or I might be wasting my time on that, or I'm unsure about that? Like, what was that personal process like for you?
That's an interesting question. I don't know that I always saw everything leading to the next, in the sense that, oh, if I do this, this is that that decision is going to lead to, doing the next sort of professional or personal activity. For example, like getting curious about how buildings stand up or fall down. I don't know that I ever envisioned that leading to, teaching classes to students about redesigning their classrooms. And the notion of like redesigning a classroom from a, like a project planning perspective, the architecture team and the contractor and the insurer and all that, that's a totally different thing than say like a, K through eight or K through 12 teacher who's like, oh, I need to redesign my classroom, which might be more about, I need to redesign the behaviors inside my classroom from day to day, or at the beginning of a semester, we're going to start with one kind of format. And by the end of the semester, we're going to change and the room is going to feel totally different, even though maybe structurally, technically structurally the room is the same, but if you walk in at the end of a semester or quarter, room feels palpably different in its energy, in its artifacts and the activities you see than it did, first day of school, or even the days and weeks before the first day of school, of course. So, did one thing lead to the next for sure. I guess I've always been sort of looking at seeing connections, and then being able to maybe respond to or provoke or explore some of those connections to see what might come next.
It's interesting that you bring up classroom space, and we'll get to prototyping. I'm excited about prototyping, but that is a topic we've talked about on this podcast before. It's something I'm really interested in. And one of the things I'm struck by is sort of the default way that we initially think about classroom space is often that at the beginning of the year, you plan out your physical space, you design your rules and procedures, and you sort of set the groundwork, and then you do your year. But part of what you're describing is a lot more iterative. There's a lot more of an evolution. And so I'm curious, what do you think it takes in terms of a teacher's mindset to say, we're going to adapt and change the physical space, but also the systems within a classroom as the year progresses?
That is a super rich topic. And my applause and praise and just admiration for everyone who is a classroom teacher, meaning finds themselves in a classroom on the daily basis and teaches with intent and intentionality about how they want to set something up. I think one of the topics that comes up in this particular book later on is seeing yourself as a host and thinking about what it means to own the role of a host. I think classroom teachers, or something I've noticed, is that whether they call that specific attribute out, that is being a host, they're in real time, all the time, conscientious of their role of creating an experience that someone else is a part of. Meaning they're walking in as, I'm an experience designer right now. Again, I don't know that they think of it with that terminology, but they say, this is what students might encounter the second they walk in this room. And here's how that aligns with maybe where I'm hoping a lesson is going to go today, or maybe a moment that I hope to sort of evoke by setting the room up in a particular way, or setting the, you know, the teams, if you're working in teams or groups or whatever, arranging students among themselves in such a way that you might sort of elicit this moment. So I think there's this sort of real-time experience design that teachers are always aware of. So a couple of hurdles, of course, are agency. Do teachers or whoever's sort of running the room, do they feel that they have control over a space in the way that a stage manager might, or in the way that a director of a play might say, I know that if I want to shift these things around, I can, and I will, and I do, versus maybe walking into a room or a venue where you have something in mind, but you don't have the agency. So as a result, you might sort of quickly partition that option out away, like get it out of your mind, because it's a hard thing to pull off. You know, if you've taught like in a classroom that's very conventionally arranged in a sort of amphitheater setting of fixed desks, focusing on, you may like a lone performer, so to speak, on stage, and you want to have like a group activity, even as like light duty as sort of turn to your neighbor and ask them a question about their day, that can be a huge challenge. Matter of factly, as a result of how the room is set up. You start to see like, oh, as a designer or a curator of an experience in this space, by looking at the constraints, I can see right away there are some things I'm not going to be able to pull off. Or likewise, oh, I walked into a room where everything is changeable, which is both an opportunity and, ooh, that can be a real challenge. Like, I didn't know I'd have to set up. I've noticed a lot of times, in particularly in sort of collaborative or evolving spaces, that this initial challenge or terror in some cases of, oh, I didn't know I'd have to set up, very quickly changes to, oh, I love this because I can set up in a way. So there's like a flip from, oh, that's right, I'm kind of on the hook for this. And at the same time, you're like, ooh, I've got an opportunity right now that I can be on the hook for this, or I have this opportunity, I have this agency to manipulate a space into an experience, into like a learning goal or curiosity I have.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that you say the piece about agency. Back when I taught at the K-12 level, I was teaching middle school, and I did a small classroom activity where, even though the physical setting was collaborative, we were in tables, the style of teaching was very project-based. I was incorporating, you know, some design thinking projects. One of the things that fascinated me was I did an activity where I made a map of the classroom, and I just had them sort of digitally color what spaces they felt belonged to them alone, right? To that, what spaces they belonged to the students all together, you know, everyone, and what spaces belonged to the teacher. And even in a space like that, it was fascinating to see that most students viewed the three whiteboards we had, which were really designed to be able to put sticky notes on and to sketch on and to, you know, it was supposed to be a collaborative space. That space and there was a table and certain spaces that they automatically just labeled as belonging to the teacher. And it was like even the notion to just go and use the whiteboard was, oh, I was giving them the permission. And so it was a really interesting interplay to me between sort of the systemic side, whether it's expectations, culture, past experiences, whatever that may be, versus the physical design, that I had to make it explicit that this space is usable to them, right? Because it was just the sea of red, because the color was red. That just happened to be the color of, like, this belongs to the teacher. And I was looking at this just thinking, wow, they don't see that as space that belongs democratically to everyone, which was really interesting to me.
Oh, I love what an awesome activity to learn from this mapping experience, both from the student's perspective and saying, "Oh, let me know what you think." I would guess that that's not particularly common, what you just asked of them. And then likewise, your ability to and interest in interpreting that. I know some themes you've touched on before in your podcast and in your work. I'm paraphrasing, but moments where you introduce maybe new behaviors or start really hint at new norms for behavior. That's a really, really big deal versus like, oh, here's what you can do with this thing and imagine what it could be. Well, you know, of course, if someone's walking into the room for the first time or into an experience and has not had either the agency or the demand or even just any hint of a previous experience like that, it would be almost more shocking if they did take control of a room. It versus like, oh, this is completely flexible. You can do whatever you want with it. Change it however. And like, I've never done that before. Like if we walked into a movie theater right now, it would be really weird to have the expectation that you set up your own chair and align it toward a screen. I mean, can you imagine that? And just the logistics of that, you're like, no, that'd be ridiculous for a number of reasons. But we get quite accustomed to saying like, well, the seat leans back or it doesn't. Just these little hints at, they're not little, it's not trivial at all, but they're small gestures that have significant impact are, what are the norms you're hinting at? Or what are the invitations that you're providing with a physical space or a protocol or even language? Like when did someone actually ask a student to rearrange their space in a room versus them walking into it arranged for them? I'm curious, actually, that you mentioned that. I wonder about a team-based activity like a sport. You did that same thing. If you thought of a classroom as a field, pitch, you know, where do those individual players or members of a team, which extends beyond players for sure, where do those people feel like what spaces belong to them, so to speak? You know,
really interesting.
You know, like is a goalie thinking that's like the coach's, like the goal is the coach's space? I would speculate probably not. You might see the opposite of the sea of red, I guess. But in that case, why? Like, why would that be? Is it because the field is like their performance space? And I don't know, students maybe, I'm speculating, but they don't, I don't know, see themselves as performers or contributors in the same way that maybe like a team or a play, like, you know, a theatrical troupe, like they might see themselves as owners of spatial attributes and locations more than students do. I don't know.
That's a really good question. I love it. I mean, you got my wheels going. I'm thinking to transition a little bit on this idea of prototyping. And I don't feel like this is too much of a transition because I feel like a little bit of what we're talking about right now is sort of the prototyping process, right? And I bring that up because when I first heard the term prototyping, I associated a prototype with something very specific. It was engineering. It probably involved like a CAD machine. Like I had this picture, and it was going to be something entirely tangible and physical and belonged solely in the zone of STEM and within STEM, really mostly engineering, right? That's how I viewed prototyping. And I think part of what you've introduced is a much broader, expansive, inclusive picture of what prototyping is. So I would love for you to speak into how you define prototyping.
Thanks for bringing that up. It's been a continued question. And that was, I had a similar, I should say, when getting started with thinking about how to address and how to dig into prototyping as a topic, I hope I approach it as a designer might and say, okay, well, I have a thought, what it means to me, what does it mean to other people? And can I learn something from that and see, oh, is there a gap there? Or is there something about why I think this word means this thing versus what someone else thinks it means? And yeah, there's a lot of technical vocabulary, a lot of ambiguity that somehow just gets sort of like washed away. Like when you say prototype among like a technical crowd, there's a silent assumption that, oh, everybody knows what I'm talking about, right? And it's a prototype. It's a prototype. That does not mean the same thing to everybody, which is something that was, I think, should have been totally obvious, but it took some intentionality to say like, oh, okay, confirmed. And I thought something that struck me in talking to a lot of people, both in technical fields and non-technical fields, I was curious, you know, what is something that's missing or what isn't being called out about prototypes and the act of prototyping? And I think the latter there is kind of a clue in saying that prototyping is experiential or could be considered experiential if you want to sort of expand your definition of it, that the idea of a prototype being a learning experience as opposed to a thing is one fairly significant switch, I think, that I was encountering anyway. And then the other is quite specifically treating a prototype as an embodied question. Very frequently, a prototype is like a conflation of, here's a solution that I hope works. Like, or I would say a conflated like possible solution and the experience is confirmation of solution or there'd be disagreement, I guess, or invalidation of solution. Yeah. And something that's missing there is really the learning in saying, I just created an experience with an embodied question. At the end of that experience, as opposed to saying, oh, I found the solution, is there an opportunity to shift that and say, like, here's something I know now about why that works or why it doesn't work that I wouldn't have known if I didn't try it. It's a lot of negatives there. But based on saying, like, if something worked, which might be a conventional, does this prototype work? Yes or no? Okay, great. If that worked, what do you know now about why it worked because of what you tried? Such that if that thing that you tried now wasn't going to be manufactured or what have you, or wasn't the right answer for the moment, what do you know based on what you just did that you could apply toward a next iteration or a next version or a next step? I think those two attributes, one, seeing a prototype, not so much as a temporal or an early solution in itself, but seeing it as a question mm-hmm. that you're asking, and then mm-hmm. seeing that question like turned into an experience that you can learn from. So it's not just a matter of, I made that thing and it's done, but it's, oh, I made that thing or I created this scenario or context. Let's see how it plays out. What can I learn from the experience of it?
Yeah, I think that was one of the, you know, I said certain things challenged me. I think I was really challenged by this idea of, although I was already at a place where I was saying, you know, a prototype doesn't have to be something made in a 3D printer, right? Like it doesn't have yeah. to be like all these things. I was already past that place, but the whole notion of the prototyping process and the focus on the learning, and that it really is not a prototype, isn't a product that you made. It is a part of the learning process and an embodied question. That was sort of my mind blowing, like, whoa, this is, and it clicked. It made a lot of sense. I thought, oh my gosh, yes. And now it viewing it in that lens, you think, well, now you're embedding reflection into the process. You're helping with student metacognition. Now, when we think about prototyping and people say, it sounds great, but how does it fit into learning? You say, this is exactly a part of the learning process, right? And so that was one of my big takeaways where I thought, I have never viewed prototyping that way. I think I had always viewed it as some kind of product, whether it's a system that you've created, whether it's an event you've planned, whether it's even just an idea that you've fleshed out fully, or something physical, tangible, something digital. But this whole idea of an embodied question was just so different as a way to think about it, which for me has me thinking about different ways of helping students reflect through that prototyping process.
Yeah, there's, it seems like for if we looked at the outputs of someone's activities, it and how a prototype gets viewed as a physical thing or a question, it seems like on one end of the spectrum, if you're, I don't know, if it's your job to make widgets or to make, screens or to make hardware, whatever, it becomes very quick in your head to say, well, a prototype is a version, an early version of a thing before it gets manufactured, which in some ways is totally true. However, it's also very easy when you're only dealing with products and physical stuff to say, oh, this isn't about the experience of evaluating this thing, or it's not focusing on what do I hope to learn from this? It's saying, like, is that the right color or texture or form factor? On the flip side, teachers, for example, and students, but teachers in particular, who iterate or go through multiple cycles of a question or a challenge or versions of things, they do that instinctively, repeatedly, like in real-time stream, but maybe don't think of their outputs or outcomes as like products. So as a result, they might not feel that they have accessibility to the same language or the ability to talk about their intentional curiosity as manifested in a prototyping process. It just seems like, oh, I'm trying some stuff. It seems really casual, while in fact, it's actually, if you wanted to look at it that way, is like really systematic, regimented, and every bit as sort of technical in a way as someone's process who might be, making the next airplane landing gear linkage.
Yeah. So if I'm imagining someone who is, say, a fifth grade teacher, right? They're in the K-12 system. They're thinking, I love this idea of what you shared about prototyping. I can kind of see a general concept of it, but I'm curious, what does prototyping look like in my own classroom? Like, what would you say to that teacher?
That's a great question, and a couple of different paths that strike me, sort of depending on where the teacher is, what their personal leanings are in teaching style, or maybe more candidly, what the demands are on them of their time as a teacher. A couple things strike me. One, prototyping benefits from like manifesting your ideas outside your own head. So I'm embodying something. I'm creating a physical thing, or I'm creating a situation for someone else to engage, so that we might both learn from this experience. So both teacher and student say, it is really beneficial to have around you materials or access to tools, equipment, stuff, that makes embodying ideas possible easily. So lowering the barriers basically to creating or embodying an idea, a thought, a sequence of events. So having physical stuff that is accessible to everybody, meaning it's not like I have to raise a hand to go get, for permission to go get something off a shelf, but say like, oh, those are our embodying tools, or those are our prototyping resources. Let's have those available, visible, and accessible, so that anybody, when they have a question, instead of doing, I'm even finding myself hand waving right now. If I just drew a picture of an idea, I could show it to you and be like, hey, this is what I'm thinking right here. So anything to actually get an idea out of your head and turn it into something that someone else can engage, that's a real big deal. So having stuff around to make, that's one, or make with. I think the next is, and this is probably most instinctive already, but it might be formalizing some language or process around what's a thing I can try, learn from, and adapt and try again. So in the same way you might try an activity or a room arrangement or a topic for a week, come to find out that it's not successful or it turned into something totally different, it would be a then say like, I just tried something, I'm reflecting on it, and now I'm going to make some changes and try another version. Or I'm going to implement or take action on the findings or the outcomes and turn that into a next step. I think teachers, I know they do, they see a thing in real time and say like, oh, that conversation after that section of reading, no one was participating. So I was hoping people would just, you know, raise their hands, jump right in. Consider that a prototype for, oh, how could I get students or invite students to share feedback or offer up a new thought? So that's shifting of like, I just tried something. What was the question I was really asking with that? Here's what I noticed. And if I'm following on that question, what's another thing I could try based on what I know now?
You know, one of the things that I loved that you got into was this idea of speed and prototyping, and kind of two different things struck me about it. One being that if you engage in a prototyping process, it's a slowing down that then saves you time. There's this very like paradoxical thing of like, because teachers will say, you know, this sounds great, but what about the time? What about the time? And that's always, there's always such a demand on time. But I was struck by that notion of slowing down to then save time, because it is a little bit of a slower process. And then the other thing was how much of a challenge for students this is, because it counters traditional schooling in terms of, if we think about it, most students internalize the notion that to be good at something, to learn it well, is to be accurate and to be fast, right? So to get it right the first time. And I've watched students who, they're fast and they're really good at it, and they're fast and they're fast and they're fast. And then suddenly they hit a place in, say, math with calculus where you can't do calculus fast, right? It requires you to slow down. Or they hit a place in, say, advanced statistics where being fast means you're missing some things that then 20 steps down the line end up being critical, right? There's a slowing down. There's an iterative, like there is definitely in stats, this iterative process to it. And to students who have identified themselves as being good at something by being fast and accurate, this is a very counter way of thinking about thinking, right? Which I love that concept. So I'm curious for you, on that first part, if you could speak to the notion of the time commitment that it takes to engage in prototyping, but why that's beneficial in the long run.
Yeah, I love the notion of it being counterintuitive. This intentional slowing down early on, which seems totally counterproductive to quickly coming up with the best idea with the lowest number of resources. I think the one thing is, you know, people who are accountable only to themselves, it can be easier to say, oh, I'm going to take a longer time to come up with a solution, because they don't maybe potentially feel an external pressure of, I have to get that right. It can be, if you've ever experienced an instance where you had the right solution, but it turned out it wasn't the right solution and the project went badly or the year went terribly wrong. What could I have tried ahead of time? What could I have tried previously? It then all of a sudden there's so much efficiency, both time and financial and resources wise, ahead of time, say like, oh, I know that actually I need to be sort of shooting towards something versus like landing on it before I try anything. So, I think the One, in terms of saying it's a deliberate slowdown, which can feel opposite of being progressive, there can or progressing, I should say, there can be a helpful tool in your own head of like breaking down any finite runway, or a meaning like I have to have an answer in 3 weeks, or I've got $1,000 summer grant and I need to have a thing, you know, by the end of that summer. If you can, in a way that works well with prototyping, is to say, well, how could I break down either the resources or the time into increments where I'm escalating? So you're actually introducing more cycles that are quicker to inform, you know, better possible solutions or better outcomes. Mm-hmm. But generally speaking, like come to the end or like the deliverable, it's like, that didn't work. Why didn't it work? Well, I didn't evaluate that particular variable, or I didn't ask that audience, or it turns out that, I don't know, this was a computer, like the success of this project was totally based on students having mobile devices. Oh, I had never asked or looked, you know, in the meantime, do students have mobile devices at their access? So I think the counterintuitive bit of it's slowing down, I think it's actually maybe more comfortable and slightly, I don't know if it's more accurate, but it's more comfortable to say, I'm going to try a bunch of little things in the meantime. And that's actually a much more efficient use of time and resources, because at the end of every micro cycle, you now have not hypothetical responses or not conjecture. You have outcomes from what you actually tried. So like, you know what? I asked students and they've already engaged in this really quickly. And that informs, or I should say that then offers a more informed next step versus always a guess. So I think the shifting it to think of more microcycles in the meantime can, that's not always obvious. It's like, I've got 2 weeks to do something. Maybe that actually means I've got 5 days to try something every day. And then I'm going to take those learnings and try something for 2 days. And that's going to help me feel really confident for that remaining, I don't know, got to work on my math there, like 4 or 5 days. And look at all those things I've tried in the meantime versus, whoo, I hope at the end of the 2 weeks, I hope this works. Like I know it'll work, or I know it'll take a direction toward a good goal that I'm looking for because of what I tried.
Yeah. So final question I have as we think about this is at both the teacher and the student level. So I'm thinking at both of these levels, what do you see as the ultimate benefit, or maybe what are some of the benefits of both teachers and students engaging in a prototyping process?
I'm always in favor of and like operate with hope that people have curiosity and that leads them to new discoveries, better life, and a better way of living. Mm-hmm. I think there is this is certainly true in K-12, mm-hmm. although I don't know that it's as common. And it's certainly not as common in even higher ed. So in like a university classroom, it is a remarkable opportunity for a student to see a teacher as a person who's learning in parallel with them. Mm. Meaning, oh, we tried this thing and my teacher learned this at the same time that I learned this. Mm-hmm. There's something I think that opens up honestly unexplored territory in education. If mm-hmm. speaking from a higher ed perspective right now, it is quite profound and is sort of shocking to students. I see it when, particularly in design classes where there isn't an answer. It's not, did you titrate that formula exactly correctly? And if it didn't turn pink, then you didn't write, you know, you didn't have the right amount of chemicals. Like there's a known thing. In a lot of design challenges and life challenges, there isn't a known thing or the right way to approach it. So that when, you know, teacher and student, hopefully teachers and students, sort of collectively see different approaches, It's less about students seeing that they had to do it the right way or the one way because, you know, the professor holds all the expertise. It's saying, oh, we all went about it in a similar way of following curiosity, trying some things, and look how everybody learned in this context. It's it's kind of awesome and quite alarming, like when a student sees, wait a second, I'm a student. I might have the most expertise in this room right now where I'm the student. Actually, it shows up that I don't know, for whatever reason, I happen to know more about this topic.
Yeah.
Cool. How could we all move forward based on the same sort of iterative curiosity approach? I think, I don't know that always fits, particularly in like K-8, K-12 situations, but there can be moments where students can both learn from sort of direct expertise, but can also, because they are always paying attention, they can learn from the modeling of the teacher in the room. Look how the teacher approached this work, or look how the teacher asked us for our feedback and the next day changed because of the feedback that we offered. You know, our experience today is different because the teacher asked us yesterday about how it went and made some changes. That's something, I mean, students can certainly learn from that directly, but they will learn from it indirectly too, whether a teacher wants it or not.
It becomes that hidden curriculum, right?
Yeah.
So as you share that, one of the thoughts I have is that at the student level, I really see, you brought this up, the curiosity, you alluded to it a little bit in your book, sort of the intellectual humility, the openness, the adaptability, all of those vital skills that they'll use in life in whatever field they go into, they develop not because you taught them, hey, this is what intellectual humility is, or hey, this is what adaptability is, but because you have, as an educator, designed a learning experience where the end result becomes, through reflection, more adaptability, more intellectual humility, more creativity, more curiosity. And to me, those are the things that I look at and think, beyond learning the content at a deep level, which I really think prototyping can do, there's these critical skills that they develop as well that they're going to use for the rest of their lives. And so that's a part of what I love in reading your book and in thinking about the application about the K-12 and the higher ed level, right? What does this mean ultimately for what they develop? And it seems like there's so many of those things, those critical skills that they develop. For people that want to learn a little bit more, I would love for you to share, what are some ways that people can find you? Anything that you want to share as we finish?
Wow. Well, they can find me. You find me standing in line probably somewhere in Austin, Texas, where I live currently. I've taught, at Stanford University and at the University of Texas at Austin, and have continued programming in a bunch of different universities in Japan. So have some educational programming there. I'll share it anyway, because I was listening to a podcast this morning. There's a remarkable guitarist named Adrian Belew, who's had, decades and decades and decades of great work and collaborative performance with bands like King Crimson, Frank Zappa, lots of other talking heads. And it was shocking. He's now 72. And it was so interesting to me how he was able to identify ways that he engaged with different ensembles and bands and what that meant to like how he was learning as a performer and a collaborator in these phases. And one thing that he ended with was the host of this podcast asked him, what's your favorite album? And Adrian Belew's got, I think it's on the order of like 23 solo albums and then the catalogs of all the other bands. But he pointed out his newest album. He's like, it's great. I never stop learning and I'm at the absolute top of my craft because this is what I'm doing right now. I thought, whoa, how cool is that? That here's, you know, here's this seasoned performer worked with, you know, the best and some of the most avant-garde and prolific musicians ever. And here he is saying, you know what? I'm actually most excited about what I'm doing right now because it's at the state of my learning and the state of my performance. So I don't know what the takeaway there is, except that I'm continually motivated and inspired by people who continue to own the opportunity that they can be active learners right now. There isn't a moment of like, oh, my learning stopped and I've got that skill. Check. It's always this, oh, how could I readapt it? How could it apply in a new way? How could I introduce it to a new ensemble or approach a new project with an old skill in a new way? I found that recently. I mean, just literally as of this morning, quite profound, and it's still really resonating with me. So I thought I'd share that.
Yeah. I think it connects to what we do as educators, as we do and as makers, right? So what a way to end the podcast. So thank you so much for sharing that. And thanks for sharing your time and your expertise.
Sure thing. I really appreciate it. Love your podcast. And it's been a real opportunity to be here and talk with you. So thanks so much, John.
Yeah, thank you. All right. So that was Scott Witthoff talking all about this idea of what actually is a prototype. Hey, would you do me a favor? If you enjoy this podcast, would you leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or wherever it is that you get your podcast? Again, thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful day and go out and make something awesome.